Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we get to have John Markland. John, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Jess. Glad to be here.
So, UK Import in Los Angeles. Why don't you tell people about what you do and your background, and then I got a bunch of questions for you.
Do you want personal history first or professional?
Wherever. You tell us. Well, tell us the business. Tell us what you do there, and then we'll get into a bunch of other stuff.
Okay. I'm probably most well-known as an acting coach. And so actors come to me, and specifically, I've kind of etched out a niche in the industry for character development. And so actors get a script, a part, and they're like, okay, now what? And so they kind of come to me, and we kind of look at where they are in their life, what's going on, where they'd like to be, where they're not, things that they'd want to work on with themselves, where that might parallel with the character, and then start to build like this inner landscape of what's the emotional journey of that. I also have an acting studio, which kind of came out of a theater company I started 15 years ago. And the studio now is in both LA, New York, and we service probably 1,000, 1,200 actors a year. My passion, my love, my home.
That's great.
Yeah.
So when your PR folks reached out and they talked about you coaching, you know, people like Rami for Bohemian Rhapsody and Dakota Fanning and some of these people, it's interesting to think of like the breadth of roles that you have to prepare people for. Let's just start there.
I came to LA, Hollywood, as a writer. I had made an independent film in Boston before coming here, in which I acted and directed, which is kind of my film school. I've always been, don't teach me, just show me and let me try. And that's kind of how we run the studio too, is just kind of like that too. I don't want to fill your head because I don't want you in your head. I want you in your body and your heart and your emotions. And so let's go with it. So I came here as a writer, and I think that foundation of story structure, character development through writing kind of gave me a great foundation from which to then start studying acting, start studying directing, start studying producing. Meanwhile, I was also on this self-healing trajectory. I wasn't on the best path when I was younger. And so I started Pema Chodron, Buddhist practicing, shamanism, anything that could help me try to understand, okay, well, who am I as a human being and how can I get to my full potential? Because I feel like I'm not living the life of who I really am. And then that led me also to Sandra Seacat. Sandra Seacat came out of the actor's studio and she focused on dream work, Jungian dream work. And so I studied with Sandra for 5 or 6 years, Jungian Institute, really trying to understand the unconscious side of me, not just the practical side of me. And it kind of all enmeshed and just came together organically where I began to feel where I'm resonating, where I'm growing, where I'm evolving. Because it wasn't so self-destructive. It wasn't such a small life. I could feel my life growing. At the same time, I was starting a theater company and writing, directing, producing. And a lot of the actors I was working with in those plays were the ones who turned around and said, hey, will you coach me or will you start a class? And so it kind of found me early on through more of the creative process than this academic approach to things. Yeah.
So, you know, you hear a name, you know, like you hear about Rami or Dakota Fanning and these people who many of us have a lot of respect for their acting and like what they've done on screen.
Yeah.
They obviously have such a foundation, but are still looking for something more.
Yeah.
Where is it that you fill that gap or how does that work?
What you find is kind of like with sports, with any collaborative effort, the people at the top of their game recognize, hey, this is a team event. Like, it's not just me. And so often actors will come to me again to help internalize, to create an emotional life that makes sense to them, that brings some of them into it, but is also of the imagination and also serves the story. And then other teachers I work with is like Jean-Louis Roerig, who does Alexander Technique and animal work. And so there's a lot of actors that come to me, do a lot of the emotional work, and then for the physical embodiment of that, go work with Jean-Louis. Voice coaches, some amazing voice coaches I work with. And so you go from the inner life to the physical life to the voice of, and so we're all creating it, but the actor is, you know, the instrument, you know, and the player. And so they're all talented people. They're all hugely creative and they could do it all themselves. But they also recognize the more perspectives, more intuitions, more experience from different places, you know, it fills it out and creates a much bigger life.
You know, so this is one of my favorite things about the show is that I get to meet all these high achievers from different sectors. And I get these glimpses of like new ideas I never would have thought of because I'm not in that world, you know, like get outside the groupthink. But then also I like seeing the similarities across genres of like what it takes to excel at anything. You know, like I have these people who on the show built billion-dollar companies or bigger, and they talk about having a CEO coach and having, you know, they've got the board of directors. It's like the official company one, but then they've got like their personal board. It's like, hey man, this is kind of crazy. Should I do it or not? You know, they've got their own people or like we have pro athletes, right? And they talk about like, they've got the team's coach and then they've got these other people they're working with, right? To help them really perform at their highest level.
And even across industry, because you're mentioning CEOs. So there's some high level, I can't mention names, but there's some high level political figures and CEOs who come to me to be like, I need to be more natural. Right. And so I'm like, well, then who are you? Right. Like, I can't figure out what natural is. And so then, you know, and it's so hard for them because they've been training themselves for so long to be a political identity. Right. And it's such a narrow version of a human being. So when I begin to push and pull and tug on those strings, it becomes very emotionally, they always get overwhelmed. And there's always this fear of, well, I can't be that. And I'm like, well, you are that. You're actually what you're projecting is not what you are. Right. And so there's a push and pull of, okay, well, what can make me more familiar and relatable to the audience, but also not so much so that I feel naked. Yeah. And it's again, so there's that cross pollination across, you know, businesses and industries. Hopefully at the end of the summer, I'm publishing a book and it's called We All Act. And it's about, the social purpose of acting, the cultural purpose of acting, and the familiar purpose of acting, and how we create identities, not just to protect ourselves, but also because it's kind of like an avatar that we can put in front of ourselves and be like, well, the avatar is going to take the brunt of this, and I can navigate from behind it, and it can achieve this. It can go into these scary situations, but it's not really me. I'm back here in the control room behind the curtain. The unfortunate part of that is though you get to those achievements and they feel empty because you feel like, well, hang on, it's my avatar that actually succeeded at this and not me. And so people are relating to this avatar that don't actually feel like the truth. And so I think part of the purpose of the book, part of the purpose of the studio is there's no achievement if it's not you. Right. And so what's this identity that you want to be seen as? What do you believe it's protecting and why? And let's see if we can slowly peel back all these layers. It's really important for actors because as an actor, if you have an identity and then on the other side of it, you're trying to play a character, you're playing through a double veil. It's like a double act. And so can we at least drop one act so you can be more creative in the character act?
You know? Yeah. You know, another field where this is actually really common is, you know, I have these like FBI counterintelligence guys that help us with Child Rescue Association or charity, or, you know, I get 25-year CIA case officers on the show who went up against the Iranian nuclear program or something like this, right?
Right.
And, you know, like they tell me stories about like going in a room with no windows, you know, SCIFs, like the secure compartmented. So, like go in these rooms with no windows for like a month at a time and role play. So the one instructor calls it the fishbowl.
Sure.
Where they go over and over in front of the other classmates and like turn theory into like kind of like uncopying, you know, stop being a cop, stop being an FBI agent, you know, like unlearning things and stuff.
Yeah, and that's a big part of the process is unlearning, right? Especially structurally within the studio, I try never to use the words good or bad. I try to lead everything through honest. And so when you're doing work, not to get to the end of it and be like, was that good or bad? Stop trying to live in this duality, which is also, it places the value system outside of yourself. And so ask yourself, was it honest? And at the end of the day, if you get to a place where it is honest and it's the true you, it will resonate. Whereas if you're attempting to be good at something, sure, it might hit luckily here or there, but it's not going to resonate in the same way because you're not coming from a place of integrity. And so again, there's this pretending, this hoping. And sometimes it works, you know, and there's also a certain formats of film and TV where I think you have to be in that place because it's so astronomically surreal. It's very hard to find, you know, something that is true.
Yeah. You know, the longtime listeners of the show know that, like, I love my art and my action sports and my child rescue. But, like, I'm trying to get, like I was saying to you before we turned on the camera, like, I'm trying to get rich enough to pay up for all the child rescue stuff and make my own movies. So I'm always watching and learning, and I listen, you know, listen to my audiobooks on screenwriting for fun. And so, last night I was watching Actors on Actors, Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan talking about The Killer and Maestro.
Right.
And it was really interesting hearing them get inside the head of those characters that are, you know, distinctly different. So different.
Right. And they are.
You know, Carey talking about animal work, which I didn't know much about. And these ideas of, like, to push themselves, to get themselves into a whole different space. And, you know, in her case, you know, embodying a, you know, a real live person that she wanted to do service to. And you know, Fassbender was talking about, you know, his experiences, I think, on hunger and representing a real person too. And, like, the difference when you're playing just a character versus you're playing someone who actually existed. And, you know, Carey talking about, like, voice coaches and learning how to speak in different parts. I think she was talking about different parts of the palate and, like, I think that was Bradley Cooper. I watched his. It was like a Directors on Directors, him and Spike Lee. And he was talking about his voice coach to become the maestro, Lemmy. I can't remember his first name. Anyways.
Leonard Bernstein.
And literally, like, speaking with different muscles and, like, really trying to, like, because they had a lot of tape of him speaking.
Yeah.
And, like, how to, like, genuinely simulate it and like, his choice to stay in character while directing the movie. So, like, he would go play the part and then he would direct. But he, you know, he had, like, 4 hours, 4 to 6 hours of prosthetics on in the morning before the show started. So, like, he was not getting out of that to be a director, right? And so he directed the whole movie as the character. And he felt like that was much more efficient.
Bradley's a bit of a phenomenon. Like, the dedication, conviction, and curiosity and depth and the extent to which he'll go is, you know, I'm not surprised he has the career that he does. He is a maestro in many ways. What the building of character that you're talking about, there's a couple of classes and approaches to the work that we do at the studio. One of them is archetype work. And so using your parents as your archetypes. And so you become your parents. At first, it feels like you're just mimicking them, right? Where you have to talk with their voice, talk with their cadence, behave like them, dress like them. And then I put them into a scene and you're not the character in the scene. You're your parent in the scene, right? Of this given circumstance. But your job is to hold the emotional integrity and the physical integrity of your parent. And what actors begin to do is they begin to realize, oh, the character I know best are my parents because I've been studying them from birth, right? Not only that, your parents have been training you, right? How to smile, how to talk, how to say dada, mama. And so that's the physical life that we inherit. But the scary part, or which I think is the magic part, is the unconscious inheritance of the parent. which is we inherit things like insecurities from our parents. We
mannerisms
about ourselves. Yeah. Even your parent could not, like, in a way, figuratively, commit a crime, but we then carry the guilt of it. And so we live our lives with these restrictions or these inherited insecurities that were never ours to begin with. And so what is it when you begin to realize, oh, hang on, I don't have to feel like I'm unaccomplished. I'm only 30 and I really have the rest of my life to discover something, but I'm holding this for my dad, who at the end of his career felt unaccomplished. And in a way, it's like a transference of love. Like, I love my dad, and so I carry this for him. But once you're able to unburden that, and this is where you sit in class, is you see actors' faces change. Sometimes their voices change, postures change. And you're like, oh my God, that person just transformed because they let go of this psychological thing that they were holding on to, which was also holding a physical representation of it. And so, yeah, your structure might actually change. And so your voice changes, your grins change, whatever it is. It's one of those things where everyone in the class suddenly gets goosebumps. You're like, what just happened? And it's letting go of that inheritance of it. So the reverse engineering of that is what Carrie and Bradley are talking about, which is you have to then build that as if you have the inheritance of whatever their family was.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that I keep making leaps to other parts of my life or people I know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think about, like, Steve Jobs and his reality distortion field and how he felt like traditional thinking.
What is that?
So it was like people saying, oh, we can't do it that fast. And he just wouldn't accept it. And he'd be like, no, I think we can. I'm like, no, you can't. And he's like, no, we can. And then all of a sudden they would, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, everything from, like, inventing the computer mouse to getting Corning to speed up the creation of Gorilla Glass and get everything ready for the iPhones in time. I mean, like, this is like a repeated thing over and over, like, just embodying this different level of optimism. Mm-hmm. And just, like, he just decided that the regular world was too hemmed in by the rules.
Yeah.
And he made all sorts of things happen that people didn't think could happen. Or, like, you know, these Delta Force commandos. We had a guy on the show who was part of the team that helped rescue the British journalist that ISIS had been. They would move the fridge, put her in the hole, and then weld the metal thing down on top of her, put the fridge over for a day, 24 hours later, cut it off, feed her. So he was on the rescue team that got her out.
Mm-hmm.
And just talking about this, like, it is almost like a like self-brainwashing. I don't know what, I can't think of a better term, okay? But this idea, like, a never say die attitude,
mm-hmm.
of, like, we are it. Like, it's us or this woman dies. Like, there's no do-overs. There's no, like, this is a no-fail mission.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if we mess this up, we don't get a second shot,
yeah.
kind of a thing. And it's like, you know, with this SEAL on the show whose leader had really just hammered into him as a young Navy SEAL, you can do anything for 2 minutes. So I don't care how bad it hurts. I don't care what it is. You can do anything for 2 minutes.
Right.
And he talked about getting blown up and being really rough and, like, basically laying there thinking, like, oh, I guess this is it.
Right.
And thinking about his men in the building that had just been blown up and his old instructor in his ear going, you can do anything for 2 minutes.
Sure.
And he dragged himself out from the rubble and went and saved some of these guys' lives and saved his own life. And it's like, not how people, like, when I'm doing a poor job of retelling the story, but like, but this idea, when you listen to him, you're like, oh, I can see why you thought, oh, maybe I'll just stay here and die,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And this, like, self-reprogramming, it's like, again, we're talking about acting here, but to me, this idea of, like, I call it the cardboard cutout. Like, what's the cardboard cutout version of myself I wish everyone believed was true?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go, like, the Boy Scout merit badge with, like, oh, Jess is a good person because of this, or Jess is acceptable for, you know, all these reasons that hopefully prove my acceptability of, like, can I step out from that cardboard cutout and be the real me, like you were talking about earlier? But then also, like, what can I do to become, like, the highest performance version of me? And that's why I was, like, really fascinated to have you on the show, is, like, I haven't been an actor. Maybe one day I'll get to be. But, like, I want to, like, I'm so interested in what that looks like in your world.
Let me just talk about that identity thing for a second. So we build these identities because they lead us into the room, right? They're our context, they're our face, they're our voice. They're all the qualities that we wish or hope we have. When you begin to peel those away, you begin to realize, oh, there are some very core beliefs that these are structured around. Like, I believe I am not worthy. I believe I will always be second best. I believe. And so the belief system then encourages the unconscious to make choices that reaffirm that belief. So that the belief, then we can build patterns and habituated rituals around, and that becomes our life. And so there really needs to be disruption continuously to pare away these false belief systems that we've built. What was the thing I was just about to say? Just lost my train of thought. Good.
Well, I've got a burning question. So if you want
to give it to me, on. I'll get back to
you. Okay. So, you know, like so many others, I discovered Rami Malek from Mr. Robot.
Mm-hmm.
But in Bohemian Rhapsody, when he's playing Freddie Mercury from Queen, the part of the film where they're literally working on the song Bohemian Rhapsody, and he's like, it's going to be like something no one else has heard. It's going to be operatic. It's going to be this thing. Like, you know, his performance is so electric that his like enthusiasm is contagious, and I'm just watching it on a screen. You know, like, there's so many times that you can tell an actor is acting, mm-hmm. right? And for me, at least at that part, I mean, he sounded like the most inspirational startup founders I've had on the show who are like inventing their entire new category of something. Do you know what I mean? It's like, nobody gets it. Nobody agrees. They don't care at all.
Yeah.
And their core people are willing to like go into the darkness with them, and everyone else tells them they're stupid and crazy and all these things. And like, it was like a visceral experience for me for him to play that part. And I'm wondering if you have any like insight for the rest of us of like, what goes into an actor's mind? I mean, you actually coached him for that movie. Like, what goes into an actor's mind to get to that level where we all get to have that kind of an experience watching them?
That's a big one.
Sure. Okay, what's one piece of that?
Okay, so we get a script, which is a story, and we read it, we look at it, what do we relate to? What are the facts of this world? He's a musician. What's his relationship to his parents? Where does he come from? What are experiences he's had that have shaped his belief system about who he is? Where does that parallel with your own belief system? Because if you can have empathy through a belief system, then you're immediately going to understand, oh, then I know how to navigate my choice making, where I hide, where I expose, where I pretend, where I am authentic. So already you're beginning to create like an emotional map, right? I know in this situation, I would choose this because I still have this belief system. And there was a lot of alignment. You know, it's been a while since Bohemian Rhapsody, but there was a lot of alignment between Rami and Freddie Mercury. They are both inspirational creatures, and they are both so, so sensitive. And so there's this hiding in and through their art, which gives them the strength that I think at times in their own life may not have been there. Right. And so there was a little bit more hiding in their own life where they can engage in who they know they are, because there's a great deal of truth. This is where I sing. This is where I act. This is where no one can question. And I won't even take any questions about who I am. And then often an actor will find a key like that. And suddenly it's like putting on a suit and you're like, oh, this is my suit. I know how to go. I remember Rami having issues with the teeth. I remember when they put the teeth in, him calling and being feeling very insecure. Like, I can't talk with these. Suddenly he put something foreign on his body that separated him from the character, right? And so, okay, well, what's the emotional attachment to those teeth? You know, like, what's the physical parallel that Rami has? You know, is it your lips or your eyes? What's something that you feel self-conscious about, but is also something that you're recognized for, and people recognize you as this brilliant artist? And so can you endow that body part with that? Yeah, it's the biggest thing for an actor is to believe themselves. And if you can get to a place where the actor feels like this is an experience, I understand and can embody and feel truthful in what I say, how I say it, how I react, how I express, how I gesture, how I move, then it's all play. At that point, they're not really thinking about what I'm doing as an actor. They are the character experiencing the moment. And that's when it goes from pretend to experience. And that's when we get these transformative, transcending experiences where like, oh, that person just became that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. Who have been some of your other, well-known clients like the Dakota Fannings or something?
Most recently, Jeremy Allen White, who has just been on a tear, winning every award that there is for his show, The Chef. And I've known Jeremy since his Shameless days. I think he might have been 18 when I first met him. And so to be a part of not just his career and his growth as an artist, but also, you know, a friend, and our kids played together, like we're growing together, to see his transformation and always know in my heart, there's a bit of a James Dean in this kid.
And what do you mean by that?
Jeremy's Jeremy at the end of the day. He's a neighborhood kid from Brooklyn. Acting isn't something precious. It isn't, something like he's not a thespian at work. He's more like a mechanic who knows how to fix a car. And that's not to say he doesn't dive in and do all the thespian like things. But his attitude around it is like, it's a job, right? In the same way that my kids are at home, my kids are growing, you know, I want to take care of them. I want to experience what fatherhood, like that's probably more important to him than what he's experiencing. He doesn't put on airs. He doesn't put on a face. He doesn't come from a place of knowing or needing to pretend like he knows. And so that leaves him in this nice, humble curiosity place where he's just always interested. Like, oh, what is that? You know, how do we do that? Oh, yeah. And again, like Rami, he has this immense sensitivity, just this sensitivity where, you know, there's always tears behind the eyes because of feeling someone's insecurity or someone's fear or someone's sadness. And at the end of the day, I think that's the doorway in to a lot of his characters. Shailene Woodley, just worked with her on a new show that should be coming out in the spring, I believe. Shailene, again, brilliant, talented.
And what's she best known for people not familiar?
What are those films? The Insurgent. She did a tentpole film, and there was like three or four of them in it. She's brilliant. She's also on the cutting edge of taking care of the environment, making sure that everything she does has a cause. There's a great responsibility that she feels with having, you know, a microphone. She's about to, I can tell she's about to start landing some roles that are the next stage in her life. And that's always something beautiful to watch when actors are transitioning from like their 20s to the 30s or the 30s to the 40s. And there's this awkwardness as you begin to fit into this new age, this new wisdom, this new experience in your life. I can see Jeremy about to go through that too, which is nice because then my scope of, oh, now we can open it up to this breadth of character, right? There's a deeper well to dive into. Because now this is lower on the priority list, and also you have more space and more capacity for holding these emotions in this place.
Yeah. You know, I'm interested. There's so many CEOs listening today, or investment fund managers listening today. That's what a lot of our audience is. Mm-hmm. Who, you know, the CEO needs to earn trust from the investment fund manager to get the investment, and the investment fund manager needs to earn trust from the family office, the institutional investor, the endowment, the, you know, somebody like this. And these are people who can be quite guarded. They're used to the world trying to, you know, see them as someone to be used, like they're a walking ATM machine or something.
Yep.
And you know, I haven't had nearly the exposure to celebrities that you have, but I've been around some, and they're trying so hard to be friendly, but so often they're ready for the, like, they're ready for the ask. Sure. You know, they're ready for the 100%. Someone to objectify them and try to use them.
Yeah.
I'm interested in any thoughts you have on earning trust from these people who are, you know, rightfully guarded sometimes.
Sure. I would say this, that guarded is a quality of untrustworthiness. And so you're already putting up a barrier or a hurdle that you have to then reach around or, you know, climb under. Or you could go into the expression and the sharing of why you're guarded, because then it becomes relatable immediately, because there is a certain level of protection we all have. So I'm sometimes brought onto set or actors are sent to me for that very reason, that there's a disconnect, a miscommunication, but the trust has been lost from actor to actor, from actor within themselves, from actor to director. And so how do I repair that? How to be? And the first thing I do is let's share a secret. Now, I know there might be this cringing from CEOs and politicians and everybody else out there, but it's the beginning of community. Like, it's, you know, like we used to sit around a fire, and what we were doing is sharing our experiences and our inner life and our dreams. And so our secrets.
You know what, you say that though? I've taken my investors on trips, and I've had like giant clients who are buying like multi-million-dollar contracts invite me out for something.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely sharing. It's, you know, I'm trying to think how to not overshare this. So there is an individual, they were buying a multi-million-dollar order from our company, and they were kind of joking around about fun stuff to do. And he's like, oh, you know, I had to have you out to their vacation property. Right. Okay, I'll keep it more anonymous.
Right.
And I was like, don't dare me to do that. I'll take you up on it. It was almost like, right? And he's like, no, I mean it. I'm like, okay, let's do this. So after an hour of knowing the guy, because I knew someone else and he was being wrong. I'm like now booked for a weekend. It's like bromantic weekend.
Because
right. Our wives weren't coming. We were just going to go hang out, right?
Yeah.
And like, we are still friends today. Years later, you know, like years and years later, you know, we're still like friends. Like we had this connection, and you know, he ended up telling me about a drinking problem from a certain family member, and I ended up sharing my, you know, what I'm trying to figure out on this, and that's how it worked.
Yeah, trust is the lifeblood of creativity. You can't create if there isn't trust, especially in a collaborative art like acting, where you're going to be acting across from someone. And so if there's a sense of threat or a sense of or lack of trust, distrust, then it's very much like when you see a child on a playground, right? And so a loud noise will happen. All the children freeze. A larger or older child comes into a mix of group of kids who are all playing. They all freeze. Play stops, right? Because is this a threat? So we go back to those, you know, the... freeze, fight, fawn, you know, like what's the primal movement here? In a creative environment, we need to be in a state of play. Otherwise, we're not going to find truth. We're not going to find the magic that happens from mistakes. We're going to be running on a program that's much more narrow. And so getting the actors to, share a secret, to get them back to a place of forget what we do. Let's see who we are and start talking to each other as human beings. When I get a new class of students in, I often give a quick rundown of my emotional journey, right? These are the fears I had. These were the demons I faced. This was how I was on a path to probably kill myself, you know, like, and in that there is an opening in them where they can grasp a hold of something being like, okay, yeah, he's not asking of me. He's sharing with me. Right, I always say that too. You have to offer trust in order to, you know, receive trust. I'm a money person. I think you've got to make it about the money comes is the least important thing in that room. Like, who am I talking to? Who are you? This is who I am. This is how I ended up here. And from there, okay, then we can talk about what we need to collaborate on.
So there's a lot of acting coaches.
Yeah.
As a percentage, very few of them have the kind of clients that you have. What do you think is, what do you think you've done different to become the kind of person that they want to seek out?
Oof, that's a good question. Like I said, like I think I've built a niche where the actors who come to me want to make it a very personal journey. And I also tend to get actors who are a little bit of a turning point or a juncture in their life where they're like, they want to try something different. And they want to maybe expose a little bit more of themselves and dive a little bit deeper than they have before. And so then they come to me. And the core of all my teachings is that there needs to be a catharsis. There needs to be a cathartic focus to whatever aspect of your life or the character that we're trying to arrive at. I myself, like a part of my training was through kind of the classic actor studio, the method. And what I found was in the sense memory work was a slight sense of being exploited, going into these very personal, intimate experiences that I've had, some of them wounding, some of them traumatic, and then expressing those through embodiment, through an emotional expression, where what I found was I felt the wound again. And after you go to these places over and over and over, actors often feel this sense of, I've used it up. And when you're talking about something like maybe your father's death, and you're like, I can't go to that place to find tears anymore. It's used up. My heart is like aching. I'm like, that's such a disconnect from such a painful, also beautiful experience of a letting go and the passing on. That's not right. And so that's when this is partly the Buddhism work and partly the shamanic work, which was just the, well, why can't that be a healing experience instead of an exploitive experience? And so you start looking at language. And so the language has to change. Instead of using an emotion, you're sharing the emotion. And so immediately it takes away that sense of this is unsustainable. At a certain point, anything being used will run out. Whereas if you're sharing, you're always going to retain some for yourself. It also changes the intention of it. Right, that this isn't really just for others, this is something that I'm sharing, so it's also for me. And then the cathartic side of it is also, how do we elevate or alleviate the pain, the insecurity, the flaw, the judgment, the criticism, the wound of this? How do we allow, how do we go back, maybe grab a hold of the child, the teenager, or whenever it happened, and say, you're coming with me, and I want you to partake in this experience. It's just, it's a psychological gesture that turns into an emotional movement. And so what you find is when you start working like that, you evolve quicker as a human being. You also take on a confidence where you can take on much greater risk of going to much more intimate places because you realize I'm not exploiting here. I'm sharing for a cathartic nature. I'm actually trying to heal myself through the work and heal others. I think that message is out there. And so I know a lot of the actors who come to me, that's what they dig their teeth into, right? There's a part of me that I've been hiding. I want to open that up. So. All right, Jesse.
Yeah, I like it. It just makes me think. Makes me think a lot. I've got this like YouTube playlist that when I need to like, when I'm frustrated, angry, feeling overwhelmed, you know, business problems, investor problems, something like this. Like one of the things I do to emotionally hijack myself, I've got this YouTube playlist. And one of the videos is this Chinese Olympic runner for the 100 meter dash who was going up against Usain Bolt. Everybody doubted him. And it's this journey of like redesigning his entire run and being the first Asian to break the 10 second and then breaking 9.9 and then getting down to 9.83 and just like this, like he says, like there's this quote from him, he's being translated. He says like, very quickly you realize the limits that physical training can give you and how much of this is emotional. And you hear that from different sports people, but when you're like this, you know, I think it's a 9-minute video or something, 12-minute video. Like, they do such a good job of showing his frustration and his failures and his training. And they got a lot of great footage. And so it just meant more when he said it.
Sure.
You know? And you can just really genuinely see him reaching this different part of himself that he didn't know existed.
Right.
And when he was at the Beijing Olympics and he ran, you know, and he ran 9.83, just like the sheer emotional raw when he won his heat.
No.
Like when you see him like break down on the track, just like screaming in joy and just like so many emotions coming out at once. And like you got to live this like 13-minute journey up to that. It's this like genuine reaching of a level that didn't exist. And you think about like how many things in business push us to be like the competition instead of being different.
Yeah.
And just the way you described it, it just like, I kind of was able to go there with you of like thinking how I see these in other areas. And so it gives me a glimpse of what that might be like in some little way for actors. You know, another thought I have is, you know, Quentin Tarantino is known so much as a writer-director instead of just a director.
Yep.
And he talks often about what an advantage that is. But recently I was listening to him talk about not just acting in Reservoir Dogs, but also how much acting has impacted his writing and how, you know, he'd really spent like a dedicated 6 years acting in acting schools and stuff before really making his breaks, and how he feels like that informed his writing so much and obviously would help with directing. And he just felt like it was such an advantage to have actually been a true, like to really have done work as an actor to inform his writing and directing. I'm guessing you would echo that, but I thought I'd ask and see if you feel similar or different.
I challenge actors to become writers and directors.
Yeah.
And I'm continually inviting directors and writers into the studio to act. It's a language, right? And if you're going to be writing words that somebody else then has to embody, you got to live it instead of think it. And what you often find with writers is highly structured, beautiful worlds with great stories. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of thought and thinking and not a lot of living, right? And so when the writer comes in and begins to act, they suddenly realize, oh, I don't need to say that. I can just look like this. I can posture like this. I can use this intonation and you'll feel the warmth instead of me having to say I feel warm. Directors, the best directors to me are the ones who have been actors. And primarily for this, a sense of trust in what the actor can do. You certainly see it with Bradley, where Bradley is able to focus on what he needs to do to become a different human being while allowing the other actors to do their work. Directors don't. What? Go ahead.
Well, you know what's funny? You know, like the point of pride is like, I discovered that punk band before everyone else. You like get this like feeling of like something special.
Yeah.
I was a total Alias fan. My wife and I had been sick this Christmas, like as newlyweds in Huntington Beach, California. We went to Walmart, I think it was like 2002 or something, bought like the Alias box set. And we just like, being sick on the, together on the couch, watched like binge watch the season, which, you know, pre-Netflix wasn't as common of a thing, right? And I remember back then being like, how is Will Tippett not a main character? Like, this guy is killing it. This guy might like to be the best guy on screen.
Yeah.
And so I feel like slightly vindicated, like he's my punk band I found early.
Yeah, he's had seemingly such an unwavering belief in himself that it's allowed for a conviction that is built upon risk. It seems no sense of safety in Bradley's course. He has sought out risk and dove for risk, and it's all of our benefit. It's paid off. Yeah, like there's a video of him when he was at the Actors Studio as an acting student asking Robert De Niro a question, and even the question was kind of poignant. And you're like, oh, like that kid's got some. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I know we're about out of time. Why don't we start with websites of the school and yourself, and if people want to get on a waiting list for the book, or, you know, like, tell us all the things.
Yeah, so the website's the marklandstudio.com. We're also on Instagram as the Markland Studio. The book, we don't quite have a release date, but I know right now it's supposed to be August of 2024, and it's called We All Act. Feel free to come to the studio. My favorite thing is when non-actors or maybe just other artists approach the studio. I think that level of experience and that sense of not knowing brings some magic into the studio. I love when people have had careers and then suddenly make a switch or a shift and realize, you know what, I've always had this dying passion to actually act or to write or direct, and they come in and that life experience translates in a way that's full of truth. They've got nothing to lose. What else?
I love it. Is there anything you want to leave us with today?
Anything I want to leave you with? Well, kind of what we were just talking about with Bradley, which is, if you really want to succeed, you've got to live in a place of risk, and it's going to feel uncomfortable. It's going to feel scary, but the more you live there, the more confidence and more belief in yourself you will gain. And it's where the creative life is, right? If you want to be an artist.
I love it. Well, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Jess. It was great talking to you.
Yeah. Okay. Bye, everyone.